Right. Well, don't panic. Hopefully, you'll all know of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. panic is exactly what, and that is, yeah, is exactly what Arthur did when he was called by his manager on a Thursday afternoon to congratulate him that he was a new head of Puppet Infrastructure. His first thought was what happened to the last head of Puppet Infrastructure. No one had seen him for a while. He had a huge brain, but he always looked so depressed. And what was Puppet anyway? It's some sort of configuration management tool that Marvin just looked after himself. So Marvin had ended up with the job, much the way that Arthur has. He'd always felt the code base was fragile, that there were errors all over the place, and it could get demolished at any point. So Arthur's second thought was to update his LinkedIn profile as soon as he gets home. So, and this is a scenario that I've seen play out quite a few times over the last couple of years. So Puppet tends to be relatively small, or the Puppet team tends to be relatively small. Sometimes it's only one person. And Puppet is a bit of a victim of its own success in that regard. You can do a huge amount of stuff with a very small number of people. And it kind of chugs along in the background, keeping configuration the way it should be, and deploying new servers. As a result, its importance in an organisation is often overlooked. And you get resistance from other teams to get involved and start writing code. So when the Puppet administrator moves on, there's a huge gap and then a panic when people trying to understand what the infrastructure is that's been left behind. And it's only when they realise they can't deploy new servers or an operating system config update needs to be rolled out manually across hundreds of thousands of nodes that they kind of understand the importance. Or when a bunch of Severity 1 tickets that have been raised would never have been raised had Puppet been stopping the database team running a script that gives themselves root access. And that is something that happened. So, Arthur needs some help in getting the environment back in order. The management have agreed to get someone who knows Puppet to help him. So we're going to look through the code Arthur is now responsible for. And we're going to use Puppet best practices to get it into a stable state. And as we go, we're going to have to explain some of the basics of Puppet to Arthur. It is all too easy to kind of launch into how powerful Puppet is when the people that we're talking to may not have ever heard of terms like idempotency or declarative versus imperative. When we explain these terms to Arthur, who spent the last 20 years writing bash scripts, is going to be a bit of a shift in his normality. We want Arthur to forget about updating his LinkedIn profile, and we definitely don't want him to end up like Marvin. So, where do we start? Culture's a big part of Puppet and making Puppet successful in an organisation. So typically different teams in an organisation don't have a common language. That is a Babel fish if you watched Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So the Linux team probably uses Bash, the Windows team might be using PowerShell, and the database team might still be using Corn Shell. The Puppet language is the same across every platform. So Puppet is all about abstraction, and the resource abstraction layer is a common language regardless of the operating system. So I was once asked to stop NTP running on a Windows machine, and I did it using my Puppet knowledge. I have no Windows knowledge. So that Puppet resource service NTP ensure stopped works on Windows and works exactly the same on Bash, on Linux, sorry. So modern infrastructures are large and complex. It's almost impossible for one person to know everything about them. And if Arthur is going to attempt to learn Puppet and become an expert in web servers and database servers and able to administer Linux and Windows, he's just not going to be successful. And one of the things that Marvin was known for was doing everything on his own. And that didn't work out so well for him. We want to encourage other teams. We want to engage with other teams. So our web admin team are experts in web servers. It makes more sense to have those experts maintaining that code than Arthur. The same for the database team and the backup team. If the backup team want to deploy a new backup agent, it makes sense for them to manage that code. They can even then manage the rollout and the decommissioning of the old agent. So all Arthur should really need to know is that there's a change coming, that he wants to take part in the code review, but ultimately that the experts who know the technologies are on the case. But we've all seen pictures like this. There are various pictures like this, and this isn't the worst. I thought the worst, the icons were far too small to show up on there. But the challenge we're going to have to overcome is all the other teams saying, oh no, not another tool. We need to make Puppet as easy to develop as we can and provide tools to do that. And it's likely they already have one of the tools that can help install on their laptops. So, another tool. Now, if you'd said to me, sort of back in the days of managing Red Hat 5 servers, that I should use a Microsoft tool for writing the code to manage them, I'd have probably given you a very strange and confused look and asked you what was wrong with Vi. Thankfully, the world and I have moved on. Visual Studio Code does make writing code a lot easier. Almost every Puppet user I've come across has got it installed on their laptop. Even if they're not using it for writing Puppet code, they might be doing Python or some PowerShell or something like that with it, or even writing all their documentation in Markdown. So next we have the PDK. The PDK, or Puppet Development Kit, is especially useful in lockdown environments. Sort of environments where they lock the desktops and the laptops down and everybody has to jump through a whole load of hoops just to get a tool to do their job. The PDK bundles all of that together, puts it on your system. Finally, we've got the Puppet plugin for VS Code, which will give you live linting as you're writing the code. It makes sense if the backup team are writing code to deploy an agent for Windows and one for Linux that they use the same tool for doing all of that. So, there's a user, Tricia McMillan, who Arthur knows from the network team. She'd been complaining to Marvin for a while about a couple of machines that were throwing up Puppet errors. They were working fine, but the errors were annoying. So this seems like a good time to investigate some of the problems. So, Tricia, or Trillian, as she likes to be called, has just had a new machine deployed. We're going to run Puppet on it and see what happens. So, nothing seems to be wrong. So we'll just give it another go. And there we've got an error. So down here, if this works, tiny little dot, we can see that there's a script has failed. So we're going to have a look at the code and try and figure out what's going on. So if you know Puppet well, which I think most of you do, this will probably make you panic a bit. But if you're kind of on your first afternoon of writing Puppet, this seems completely normal. So we've got a bash script up here, which is just running the group add command and the user add command. And then they've had a go at puppetizing it. They're going to copy the script down there, and then they're going to run it. But it's going to run every 30 minutes. And what's going to end up happening is the next time it runs, the user already exists, and the group already exists. So the script fails, and that's what we've seen it do. So we can fix this in two different ways. The first we're going to do is teach Arthur about idempotency and how to use the exec properly. Idempotency is when an operation can be applied multiple times without changing the result beyond the initial application. Or once we've run that script and created the Trillian user, we don't need to create it, we don't need to run it again. So the first thing we need to do is control the execs. So we'll get rid of the script entirely, but while we have it, we can use it to explain the best practices when using execs. So the first is to stop them running every Puppet run, which we've done here. with this line here, the creates home trillion. So that tells Puppet that the script creates that directory, and if it sees that directory, then it just won't run it. So in this example, someone could still delete the trillion user, change her group membership or comment, and the script wouldn't run because the home directory would still be there. So we could just do it in Puppet. So here's the Puppet. With Puppet, we just define the resources and the desired state, and we're using the user resource, and we're specifying that user's desired state. So we're also going to use the group resource. We're going to specify that desired state. So this is idempotent. Each time Puppet runs, it's going to check the system for those resources. If something has changed, it's just going to change them back. So, and this, excluding the home directory, would work on any system, Linux or Windows. So Arthur, being new to Puppet, is not going to know about facts. He doesn't know anything. He's never heard of them before. But facts is a series of scripts, and it's all Puppet knows about that server. So in this example, the operating system is Ubuntu, and we can make decisions in our code about what's going to happen as a result of different operating systems. Like if we're installing Apache on here, we can just install the Apache package. If we're on a Red Hat machine, we'd have to install httpd instead, and we'd just be able to use that fact to do that. But sometimes we may need something that isn't included in the standard set of facts. So we could create an external fact to tell Puppet where we are. So here we're going to run a factor location, and it's not going to have anything because we haven't set that fact yet. We can just drop a file in the right place and say location cybernetics A. So now when we run factor again, we'll have some information about where that system is. Right. But be careful with your external facts. There has been a complaint. Puppet runs are taking too long, and it seems that factor is the cause. So it's very tempting to load a system up with every fact that you think you might need, but there is a price to pay. Every script is going to run every 30 minutes, and the output of this script is going to end up in your Puppet DB. So we need to ask two questions. Is this really needed on every server? And does it need to run every 30 minutes? So luckily, the person who wrote that script is still here. Sorry, that's Benji. So we can go and ask him about what he needs from that script. So he's confirmed that it's only needed on nodes running the DB profile, and the file systems don't change that much anyway. So rather than deploy the script as a fact that's deployed to every single server in the environment, we can just deploy it to servers that are running the DB profile. And then we only really need to run it once per day. So this is a good opportunity to give Arthur and Benji, in this case, a bit of a demo of how Visual Studio Code and the PDK can work together, and also give them a demo of some basic resources, which Arthur has already had from puppetizing the trillion user. So that's the PDK plugin. And then we can run PDK version to show the version of PDK that we've got. And we're going to create a new module, DB module. It's going to ask us a few questions about who wrote it, what operating system we're expecting this to work on. and then it's going to build out all of the directory structure that we'd normally find on a Forge module. Task directory, the metadata file, which has got the answers to the questions that we had to answer. So we're going to create a new file, and we're going to drop Benji's script into here. There we go. And then we're going to create a new class file. So we have to CD into the module first. PDK new class, create the class for us. There it is. And then we can chuck the resources in that we need to drop that fact script onto the target machine and run it. So it's going to go in the home Benji mounts sh file. It's going to be executable owned by Benji, and it's coming from the modules DB module, and which is there, and mounts, which is in the files directory. Puppet already knows that it's in the files directory. We don't have to specify that. So then we're going to drop a resource in there that's going to run it as a cron job once a day. There we go. And it's going to output the results of that into a YAML file that's in facts.d. And then we're going to do PDK validate with an autocorrect. So you might have noticed up here, this kind of looks a bit out of place. We start running the PDK. So this is going to kick off all the linters and check things like, to begin with, the metadata JSON file, any metadata files that we'd have put in the task directory, of which there aren't any. We're going to look at the Puppet manifest data. If you keep an eye on that, this may well jump back into the place where it should be. There it goes. It'll carry on and check for any Ruby code that's in there, which we don't have any. And then finish. You can see here, we've got a load of corrected messages. So, the other thing is, I'll just pop back. Yeah, so we fixed our first problem. Next is to code defensively. Arthur's conversation with Benji went very well. Benji's agreed to take a bit more responsibility of the DB profile and bring some of his colleagues in the database team along. So his colleague Frankie has some code that works, but he's not sure he's gone about it the right way. First thing, he's exploiting the fact that any script placed in the facts.d directory is going to get run when factor runs, and that's a bad habit to get into. The only thing that should be in there is either static fact files or scripts that output directly to factor. And even then, we know that you put too many scripts in there, that can be problematic. We found that with the modules or the mounts fact. So if we look into the profiles class, if the DB environment isn't set to prod, then the Postgres dev package is going to get installed. And as this fact is dropped in place during the first Puppet run, the first set of facts that have come in won't include that, which means everything is going to get the dev packages installed. He's also referencing the fact as a topscope variable. So topscope variables can come in from various places, either from the node as a fact, or they can come in from some logic that's set in SitePP. An important best practice is to be clear. And we have an opportunity here to add some clarity to this. So we can show where the variable came from by referencing it slightly differently. in this case, by specifying that it's come from the facts. So now anybody reading this code knows that it's come from a facts on the actual server and hasn't been set by some kind of logic in SitePP. So, so Frankie's bash script that generated the facts were using the IP range to figure out where it was. But we already know that Arthur has set the Cybernetics A location. And in this case, we've got Cybernetics A and Cybernetics B. So Arthur's providing those, so they've kind of become a bit of a standard within the organisation. So it's going to be a best practice to use the stuff that's already there rather than try and reinvent the wheel. So we should switch over to that. And it's also effectively a standard, so we can be sure that if Cybernetics builds another data centre, Arthur's going to populate nodes in that data centre with something like Cybernetics C. We can also encourage Arthur and Frankie to code a bit more defensively. If for any reason the fact isn't there, instead of defaulting to sticking the dev packages in place, we're going to fail the Puppet run. So here, if Cybernetics A, Cybernetics B, we'll put those in place, and or else we'll have an unsupported location. Having your code fail is not a bad thing. Misconfiguring a system because you've hit a situation you hadn't planned for is. So we'll take a look at this code in real life. So factor location is Cybernetics A, so we would expect the package Apache 2 dev to be absent. And that is what's happening here. I don't know if those blinds can come down a bit more. Sorry, press the button at the wrong time then. So we can have a go at Cybernetics B. It's a test machine, so we can test out different locations. There we go. In B, we're expecting the Apache 2 dev tools to be present, and that's what we've done. So we'll have another go and see what happens now that we've got a slightly more defensive code. If we were to deploy this into a data center which we didn't know how to handle. So we've got factor location, Cybernetics C, we'll run Puppet agent again, and hopefully what we'll see is this unsupported location come up, which we have here in our message. So being quite clear about what's going on. So, Hira. Arthur's probably never heard of Hira, but it's probably going to be one of the most important things he has to deal with. In fact, using not much more than Hira and some Forge modules, you can have a good go at managing your entire infrastructure. Hira is a hierarchy. So you can think of it like an address. We have our house number and our node, our street, data center, our county, our domain, and then our country and common. So we should probably take a look at Arthur's Hira file, and we can see this. This isn't the worst I've seen. I have seen a customer's Hira file, Hira.yaml file, over 100 lines long. but it's okay, but we can improve it. So we're going to have a look at each of these levels and see what we can do about shrinking them or adding a bit more logic into here. So we've got nodes first, which looks okay. We've only got one node that's specifically mentioned in there. We really want to try and stick to the idea that nodes are livestock rather than pets. Don't want to have individual custom configurations because that just doesn't scale very well. So next we've got a single source of truth. We've got roles, but we're going to look at this at the same time as domain, because there seems to be some duplication here. So under roles, we've got cybernetics. And in there, we've got the role of the machines, the doors on the bistromath, or the Nutramatic on the Heart of Gold. But we have cybernetics YAML, and that has no logical difference to the cybernetics under the domain. So we've got that one, and cybernetics.com.yaml. And the same with deep thought. So somebody could come along and add a value under domain cybernetics and be left wondering why it has no effect. So that could be because the hirer finds the value in roles cybernetics first. So we've got rid of those unrequired directories, and we've merged the cybernetics YAML with the cybernetics.com.yaml and deep thought YAML with deepthought.com.yaml to give us a single source of truth for those two domains. So it looks a lot clearer. So keep things simple. So if we look at the machine, this is a completely unnecessary directory structure that we've put in here. And if we chop that out and make it a bit more logical, we can go back to this. We have the data, operating system, CentOS YAML, Ubuntu YAML. It also becomes much clearer how we would support another operating system. Factor's just going to provide us with the OS name, and we can drop that YAML file into here. And do we need it now? This looks logical. But if we look back at the section in the hirer YAML file, we can see that there's an extra lookup up here. So this is a project that the network team are looking into to split the networks in the data centers. So don't add complexity until you need it. So definitely don't add it because you might need it. So hirer can often get littered with lookups where somebody thought, I reckon we might need that in the future, or it might be useful. So this project hasn't really happened or kicked off yet, so really we should just remove it. And that's what we'd end up with. And delegate as well. So this is a security section that has an interesting history. It was shoved in here at the request of the security team. I've kind of shown it in context because it doesn't follow our hierarchy at all. It has its own common YAML file, which sits directly in the directory, in the security directory. It should be at the bottom and merged in with our common YAML file, but the general consensus is that that would end up in a bit of a nightmare of merge conflicts and rebasing. The DMZ looks logical. Lord, the DMZ logically should be before the domains. The domains, as we're talking about internal and external DMZs within each domain, and it's just the way the security use the same ones for either domains. There are other considerations. The security team work to a very different cadence to everyone else. We hear nothing from them for weeks on end, and then suddenly they've got a bunch of critical changes that need to go in the next couple of hours. So it'd be much easier if we didn't have to deal with them, and they've given us no doubt that they feel the same about us. It would be much easier if we just didn't have. So since Hirer 5, it's been possible to put Hirer lookups within a module. So this was to replace the params PP class or inheritance pattern, and if you don't know what that is, then it's best to leave it like that and don't go looking at the Puppet Labs Apache module that's on the forge for a particularly scary example. So best practices are that they're best practices, they're not the law. So if we considered the best practice when writing a module, we should always imagine that we're going to put it on the forge. and not put anything that kind of ties it back to our own infrastructure. That has two advantages. We could change our minds and put it on the forge, and then we benefit from the assistance from the community to fix bugs, add functionality, update it when operating systems changed or new versions of operating systems were released. And the next is that we implement that module the same way as we implement all of our other modules. Now, the security team are going to break that that best practice by putting data in there that's specific to the DMZs, and so that's going to link it back to our organisation. In this case, though, we've got a clear advantage in doing this, so we're going to move that HIRA data lookup into the data directory of their own module. And there it is. We can just move it in and update the HIRA file to work with it. So there are some things to consider when you do that. So our main HIRA data was at the global level, or at the global scope. So any module could look up a key in that data and would get a value returned. So this is not the case with module HIRA. The data in there is in the module scope, so only a search from within that module will work. If there was something in that data that another module was using, it's not going to be able to return a value anymore, and it's going to start failing. When we told the security team this, they were delighted. So clean up after yourself. If we have a look at the HIRA file, we have an extra search in here as well. That's here. This was used by the DAWS application, but it's not used anymore. It's very easy for HIRA to collect junk over time. If you stop using something, remove it. So that's how we started, a pretty big HIRA YAML file, and that's where we finished. There was one thing that I did was to move the domain down to here. We've got two domains, so logically that would sit just above our common file. But it's worth thinking where things go. So if we took the example of Nutramatic debug mode false, where would we put it? In theory, we'd put it in common because it's common across all of our, it's the default value. But it might be more logical to put it in the applications.yaml file. It would be easier for the application team to find. So again, it's best practices just to make things clear. So if it makes more sense to put it in there, put it in there. If it makes more sense in common, put it in common. So parameterize your classes. So we've got our baseline here. And if we're in Cybernetics A, we're going to use this IP address, or if not, we're going to use that IP address. The first thing we can see is that this is going to need a code change if we make any changes to the IP addresses. What happens if we add a new data center? So let's say Cybernetics have a particularly good year selling new Nutramatic machines, and they have to build another data center. We could end up in this situation. So, fortunately, Arthur's just had a very comprehensive lesson in HIRA. So we can use that to solve this problem. So this is a parameterized class. It looks simpler. That's because we've shifted all of the logic back out to HIRA. We saw that how the hierarchy worked. We have a fact on the target node, and that says the location Cybernetics A. So we're going to look for Cybernetics A.yaml and see if there's a key. Profile baseline source, and if there is, it'll return that value. So as we're here to talk about Puppet best practices, and earlier I mentioned about the PDK, a very important best practice is to validate your code with the PDK. It checks the syntax and the style guide. So writing code consistently is critical if you're going to be expected to have others maintaining it, or you're going to leave other people behind to maintain it like Marvin did. So we'll have another demo. So we've got this first attempt at writing this baseline, and we're going to run PDK validate. So So again, it's doing what it usually does and firing up and going off and looking for the JSON files first, the task JSON and the metadata JSON, and it's gonna check the Puppet syntax. Again, there's some double lines here, which clearly it's gonna pick up on. We have no Ruby code in there, but we've got a stack of errors. We've got the soft tabs one, which is just sort of how it's laid out on the page. Again, these empty lines at the end. But then we've got no documentation for our class parameter, and we haven't got a data type for our class parameter either. So we can put some documentation in there, and that tells the user of this class that they need to provide us an array of NTP sources. And then we can tell Puppet what we're going to be giving it, which is, again, an array of NTP sources or an array of strings. We can run PDK validate again, and this time we'll add the autocorrect in there and we'll fix all of the problems that we've got down here. So again, this is going off to do the validators or the linting tools. We'll start with our metadata file again. We should see any minute now, these will disappear. There they go. And it's looking for Ruby files, there aren't any. And so you can see here, it's corrected all of these errors. So, strong typing. The update to the profile code got released. We left it up to the network team to fill in the IP addresses of the NTP time sources because the sources were all coming from their kit. So there'd been a report that in Cybernetics A, the time on the servers was all drifting, and so the Linux operations team had gone in and had a look, and they've said that the IP address that we're using for the NTP source is misconfigured. But we're not getting any messages from Puppet to say this. All the Puppet runs are finishing clean. That's because the data we're passing it isn't a valid IP address, but it is a valid string. So there is something we can do about it. Standard lib has an extensive range of types, and we can use one of those types. If you need a type and it isn't in there, then create it and put a merge request in to get it pulled into standard lib. So, just run through this. So, that's the problem with our IP address. So we can go back to the code here, and we can get rid of this string because we know that a string isn't enough. We can put an invalid value in there. So we're gonna use standard lib host. And what that's gonna look for is a pattern that is either an IP address or a host name. Running. Here we go. So we've made that change and I've pushed it up to Git and it's been deployed to Puppet, and now we're going to run Puppet agent again and see what happens. So now we've got this error, and this would have been really useful when the network team updated the IP address, because we'd have known within minutes that there was a problem out there. And this is telling us that there's a problem. It doesn't conform to this standard lib host. So we'll go in and we'll change that value now to a proper IP address. So now we've got that proper IP address in, I've made the change, pushed it up to Git, it's been deployed to Puppet, and now we're going to run Puppet again. And now we can see we've updated the server, the server's IP address. Right, so a data layer. So you should always know where your data is. Much of Puppet best practice is about consistency, and we need to be consistent and know where things are and that things are where we expect them to be. So we've had this message from Lunkwill. Hey Arthur, we asked Marvin to change the port on our web server. He said he'd do it and then suddenly left Cybernetics. I hear you're the lucky chap who's taken over from him. We just need web app port 81 changing to web app port 80. So we're going to have a look at that data. So a profile represents how we use a component module in our organization. So we should always be consistent with passing configuration into our modules via a profile. This consistency means we always know where things, where to set things and where to set parameters. And we don't have to go hunting through Hira or our classes to figure that out. Now the web server profile has been pretty clear for this. It's been consistent. We've got our doc route, the owner and the port. But what we can see here is Arthur's gone and, or Marvin in this case, has gone and done exactly what the team have asked him to do, which was just to update this. Now, quite rightly, the profile is taking precedence here, so it's still setting it to port 81. So what we are going to have to do is get rid of this, update this value, and what Arthur's going to have to do is go and hunt through the Hira data and make sure that all of the data is being pushed in through profiles rather than through the modules directly, so that any avoid any confusion in future. So roles. Roles should not have logic in them. If a role can do two things, it is two roles. The web app team have been deploying the marketing web server production instances into Cybernetics A, and they've been deploying the development one into Cybernetics B. Now, the marketing web team have decided that they want to deploy a production instance into the development environment and then put a load balancer in front of it. So in the event of one of those data centers going down, they still maintain their service. They've done it. The security team have scanned the servers, the production server, and said there's a load of dev packages on there that shouldn't be on there. And the web app team has said they've deployed it exactly the same way as they always deploy their servers. So what we need to do is create two different roles. So we can see here, what's happening is when they deployed their production instance into Cybernetics B, included the web dev tools class, which put all of those packages on. To minimize impact, we're going to keep the role marketing web server, so that's as it should be, and just create an additional role marketing dev web server, which that one has the web dev tools included. So there's not going to be any confusion in future. So, securing your data. We've got another mail, this time from Benji. They've just had a stern talking to by the security team. They were scanning their servers and found their super secret password in plain text in the Puppet catalog. So, we'll go and take a look at that. So, we're in OptPuppet Labs, Puppet, cache client data, and that's the directory where the cached catalog is kept. So this was what the security team were looking at, and we can go and look at, we can use JQ to go and look for the user, which is that user and the title Postgres, and pull out the JSON file or blob for that resource. So if we do that, we can see the resource here. If we go down, we can see their super secret password down at the bottom there in plain text. So what we're going to do is use the node encrypt module, and we can tell Puppet to encrypt this value when it arrives on the server, or use the server certificate to encrypt it. So we've made that change. We've pushed it up to Git. It's deployed to the Puppet server. So now we can run Puppet Agent again. So nothing different has happened. Nothing's changed. But if we go and have a look inside the catalog now, instead of seeing the password, that's the user Postgres resource, those are its parameters. And if we go down to password, which is here, we can see we've got no decrypt and we've got this encrypted string. So, normality has been restored. We've engaged with other teams. So Arthur isn't on his own the way Marvin was. We've got a common development environment that is consistent across all of those teams, which makes it a lot easier for Arthur to help and people to help each other. We've got some standard coding practices, coding defensively, using parameters instead of putting logic directly into the code. And we've returned logic to Hira. Finally, we secured data and stopped passwords appearing in plain text in the catalog. So, some acknowledgements, the background image, and if anybody wants to go and have a look at that code, all the examples that were in those demos is up there on GitHub under my account, so you can go and have a look at that control repo and all those roles and profiles are there. Right, thank you. So, any questions?
So, I have a question.
Go on.
The node encrypt, does that just encrypt that thing in the catalog?
Yes.
Just the catalog itself?
We're assuming that they've managed to get that value probably encrypted in Hira using eYAML, and they're using the secret, but I think at the time of putting this together, if I put all of that into the presentation, it was going to overrun considerably.
This is really good when the module doesn't support the sensitive data type.
Oh.
It's a nice fallback when the module doesn't directly support using...
Yeah, like if you set a user's password using the user, it'll... Does it encrypt it there? I can't remember.
I'm not sure if the user type actually supports it or not.
Right.
Thank you.
Okay.